The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack from the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass! Want to talk to them? Give them a call at 919-781-1973. And now we return to the June 2020 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. This is the annual coastal issue. And we're going to begin with an article entitled Echo of the Bones. In Carteret County, a marine, I guess you want to probably say Carteret County around here. I just never forget my high school French. In Carteret County, a marine curator and dedicated volunteers have found a way to bring beached whales back to life. By sharing the creatures' stories at the Bonehenge Whale Center, they've turned heartbreak into inspiration. Written by Jimmy Tomlin. In January 2004, when a young sperm whale washed up on a remote shore at Cape Lookout, Keith Rittmaster and a team of marine experts went to investigate. As the curator of natural science at the North Carolina Maritime Museum in Beaufort, Rittmaster had seen stranded whales on the North Carolina coast before, about 140 sea mammals wash up each year. But there was something different about this one. Here was the carcass of a 33.5-foot mammal, essentially intact, lying on the sand. Rittmaster and the others began to discuss what should be done with a massive whale, and a veterinarian posed some questions. Could they make something positive of this? Might they learn something new about these great creatures if they stripped down the bones, cleaned them, and reassembled the skeleton? Perhaps it would be possible to put the skeleton on display for the public to see. Imagine the teaching opportunities. The group saw the potential, but they also understood how much work the project would take. Rittmaster put together a team of volunteers to begin the long process. To clean the bones, he used a technique that calls for them to be buried in sandy soil for several years, long enough for insects, microorganisms, chemicals, and temperature to break down all the tissue. This approach requires patience, he says, but it's great for getting the bones almost spotless. The bones were checked annually, and finally, 4 years later, they were exhumed and ready to be reassembled. But there was a problem. Where exactly does one go to rearticulate the skeleton of a 33.5-foot sperm whale? We had no place big enough to put it together, Rittmaster says. So a bunch of supporters, a private landowner, and some donors pooled their resources to build a structure in the woods specifically for the whale. We called it Bonehenge, he says. It was truly a community barn-raising effort. The name is a play of the famous prehistoric Stonehenge in England, and the building process really was a kind of structural wonder. In only 8 days, in January 2009, 22 volunteers erected a 20-foot by 40-foot single-story pole barn on a concrete slab in a patch of woods. It was fully wired with electricity, but also featured plenty of windows for natural light, as well as a 10-by-10 rolling door large enough to remove the skeleton after it was completed. For 3 years, Rittmaster and his band of enthusiastic helpers painstakingly reassembled Echo, the name later given to the whale in an outline naming contest, inside that simple barn. Damaged bones were repaired, and the cleaned bones were soaked in hydrogen peroxide to whiten them. Piece by piece, the skeleton took shape until finally, in March 2012, some 8 years after the whale washed up at Cape Lookout, Echo made his public debut at the Maritime Museum, where he still hangs on display today. 8 more years have passed since then, and another public debut is planned. The unveiling of the new Bonehenge Whale Center in Beaufort, a workshop dedicated to the close relationship between North Carolina and the cetacean, I guess it is, C-E-T-A-C-E-A-N, cetacean order of sea creatures, which includes whales, dolphins, and porpoises. Unlike the little pole barn that inspired this new venture, the center is an open two-story building, approximately 2,000 square feet, adjacent to the North Carolina Maritime Museum's Gallants Channel Annex. A few rearticulated dolphins hang from the ceiling, while others are still in the process of being put back together at stations throughout the center. A giant mural along one wall depicts a mother Cuvier's beaked whale and her calf. A balcony encircles the building's interior, giving visitors a bird's-eye view of the workspaces and the displays below. Rittmaster marvels at how the original Bonehenge project laid the groundwork for the second one, which is scheduled to open later this year. A bunch of us sat around the kitchen table one night, and we decided to see if we could build something bigger and better to support this kind of work, he says. Just like with the first Bonehenge, it was another community barn raising. North Carolina's history with whales dates back to colonial days. Coastal fishermen took advantage of the mammals that stranded themselves along the state's shoreline, harvesting their carcasses for blubber, oil, meat, and whalebone, which was often used in the manufacture of collar stays and women's corsets. Eventually, a modest whaling industry developed along the coast and lasted for well over 200 years. One of the most famous whales killed during an era like this was Mayflower, a 50-foot right whale. Brought to shore in 1874, Mayflower's rearticulated skeleton now hangs on display at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. In the early 1900s, the state's whaling industry died out for several reasons, including overhunting, violent Outer Banks weather, and changing fashions that diminished the desire for whalebone corsets. North Carolina's fascination with the great creatures, however, apparently never waned. Here's something mind-blowing about North Carolina that most people don't know, Rittmaster says. There are about 90 species of cetaceans on Earth, and we have documented 34 of them here in North Carolina. That's more than any other state in the country. That's more than all of the states to our north combined, and it's more than all of the states to our south combined, including Florida, which has over 4 times the coastline. The roster of these mammals documented in North Carolina waters is vast and includes the gigantic blue whale, the largest animal on Earth, and the sperm whale, which has the largest brain on the planet. It includes the dwarf sperm whale and the pygmy sperm whale, the killer whale, the pygmy killer whale, and the false killer whale, the humpback whale and the melon-headed whale, the bottlenose dolphin, the rough-toothed dolphin, and the harbor porpoise. There's something special in North Carolina with regard to whale diversity, Rittmaster says, and I want North Carolinians to know this. Rittmaster wasn't always this enthusiastic about whales. Growing up in New Jersey, he liked wildlife, but he didn't care about anatomy. At 18, though, when he moved to the Outer Banks as a surfer, he developed an affinity for the dolphins he saw swimming around him. Then he witnessed the first whale stranding, and it changed his life. He pursued a career in the study of marine mammals and landed a job at the Maritime Museum in 1990. Today, he even tools around in a car with a dorsal fin on top of his car. During graduate school at Duke University, Rittmaster met his future wife, Vicki Thayer, who serves as the Marine Mammal Stranding Coordinator for North Carolina's Central Coast. Together, they have dedicated untold hours to the Marine Mammal Stranding Network, which responds to reports of stranded whales and dolphins. They also founded the North Carolina Monofilament Recovery and Recycling Program, an initiative aimed at ridding the ocean of one of the deadliest killers of whales and dolphins, improperly discarded fishing gear that entangles these unsuspecting animals. In the past, when whales stranded themselves, they were scavenged for their products. Even today, their bodies are typically disposed of in one of three ways. They're buried right where they die, they're towed back out to sea and left to the elements, or they're exploded. More and more frequently, though, the beached animals are collected and examined and given postmortems to understand why they died. While scientists aren't always able to determine a whale's cause of death, oftentimes they can accurately say who killed it. Us. And that's where Rittmaster hopes the new Bonehenge Whale Center can begin to make a difference. The bones practically jump out at you when you enter Bonehenge. The entrance is an archway formed by the huge mandibles of a 46-foot-long right whale. Some of the bones have been cleaned and rearticulated to reassemble marine mammals that appear to be swimming as they hang from the ceiling. Others are still in the midst of being reassembled. Still, others have been stacked as they wait for Rittmaster and volunteers to reassemble them, too. All of these bones, every animal in here has a story to tell, Rittmaster says, and it's a story that needs to be heard. He points to the lower jaw of a right whale. I want you to put your hands on these, because where else can you do this? This is one of the most endangered large whales on Earth, and it lives off of our coast. This particular whale, an adult female, stranded in Nag's Head in 2011. Rittmaster says that she fell prey to fishing line and was struck by a ship. The two most common causes of death that can be determined among whales that strand in North Carolina. He points to a dolphin, Lionel. He became entangled in monofilament fishing line when he was very young, and he continued to grow around the fishing line. A painful evolution led to infection and swelling. Nearby, there's a baby pygmy sperm whale that fell victim to marine debris. A large plastic bag was found in his stomach. The 37-foot-long humpback whale was struck by a ship, severing her skull and probably killing her instantly. I'll admit it sometimes gets depressing or macabre thinking about what happened to these animals, Rittmaster says, but when I can build a display that addresses a conservation issue, I kind of get excited because I want people to know about these problems. I'm hoping it will make them take care. That's what happened to Kerry Spencer, one of Bonehenge's most active volunteers. One afternoon this past winter, the Beaufort resident found herself sanding the ribs of a pygmy sperm whale as she helped Rittmaster rearticulate the animal's bones. She became passionate about the cause after hearing Rittmaster speak to a local group, and she showed up one morning to help out. Now she jokes that Rittmaster can't get rid of her. I love the idea that I'm working on something that will outlast me, Spencer says. I want people to see this and be fascinated by it so that they'll try to do a better job of conservation. I want people to care and to know that they can make a difference. North Carolina Maritime Museum, Gallant's Channel Annex, is in West Beaufort Road Extension, Beaufort. They have a website, NC. Maritime Museum, Beaufort, NC, .org. Nope, excuse me, .com. And now, an article entitled Secrets of Southern Chefs. The dog-eared, food-splattered pages of cookbooks hold recipes that define our state as well as our palates. These vintage dishes are sure to remind you of supper's past and will make you feel right at home. Written by Kathleen Purvis. People love to say they read cookbooks like novels. Not me, though. I read them like anthropology books, like history books, like atlases, and sometimes like actual road maps. At this point in my life, I don't need cookbooks to teach me how to cook. I've been a home cook, food writer, and newspaper food editor for most of the past 40 years. Stand me in a kitchen in front of a stove with pretty much any ingredient, and I'll figure out how to use it. I don't need cookbooks to tell me what to cook either. Thanks to Google, cooking newsletters, and friends on social media, I have more want-to-try recipes than I'll be able to make in several lifetimes. What I need my cookbooks to do is show me the way to understand how something was cooked, why it was cooked, and most importantly, who cooked it. That's why the cookbooks I treasure are spattered, stained ones, the ones with age-brown pages and local folks' names under the recipes. My shelves are packed with these personal and practical volumes, community cookbooks, church cookbooks, and junior league productions. Which cookbook can tell me the importance of drum, another name for channel bass, on the Outer Banks? That would be the tiny original Ocracoke cookbook published decades ago by the United Methodist Women. Within this slim volume, there are 7 recipes for drum, stewed, creamed, boiled with potatoes, fried, baked, and smothered. It's like the Waffle House hash browns of fish. When I want to understand the connection between ginger cake and Moravian sugar cake, the late Beth Tartan's classic North Carolina and Old Salem cookery comes to my rescue. And is it true that no one cooked with garlic in the 1950s? Not according to the 1951 edition of the Southern Cookbook by Burlington's Marion Brown. The hors d'oeuvre chapter alone practically reeks. When I left my newsroom job last year and came home to work on my own as a writer, I did some serious cookbook culling. But there are a dozen or so I will never part with. The ones I grab when an editor asks if I have ever heard of a tomato pudding or what to do with cornmeal dumplings. In part, I hang on to these books because they would be hard to replace. You'd have to search used bookstores or online book sites to find some of them, but mostly I keep them close at hand because they've fed generations of North Carolinians and they've given me countless memorable meals. Coastal Carolina Cooking is one book by Nancy Davis and Kathy Hart, UNC Press in 1986. With help from UNC's Sea Grant program, Davis and Hart put together this unusual book by finding 34 home cooks from Maple to Holton Beach to share stories about growing up in isolated coastal communities and the food made from local ingredients that they ate, focused on people and places. The recipes are a jumble, grouped by communities instead of type of dishes. Recipes cover things you won't find in other cookbooks: bear roast, molasses pie, and collards with Irish potatoes. Seafood abounds, of course. If it swims, crawls, or lives in a shell along our coast, it will turn up somewhere in these pages. Now, I'm going to skip the recipes that are scattered throughout here. Cooking on Hazel Creek, the best of Southern mountain cooking, compiled by Dwayne Oliver, self-published in 1990. Dwayne Oliver's book is a very simple project. It even looks like it was hand-typed with plenty of little typos. But no less an expert than Ronnie Lundy, author of the James Beard Award-winning Victuals, or Vittles, I guess you pronounce it, in an Appalachian journey with recipes, recommended it to me. Hazel Creek near Fontana Lake disappeared in 1944 when the people who lived there were moved out to make way for the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Oliver grew up there and has written several books about the area. His cookbooks cover the food of Cherokee families in a few fascinating pages, then concentrates on local recipes in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Some of the recipes are newer, with convenience products creeping in, but the older ones are a trove of things like gritted bread, made only in late summer when corn is starting to dry on the cob, and poor dough, fried leftover cornbread. The original Ocracoke cookbook, published by the United Methodist Women of Ocracoke. If you stumble upon a copy, you may think there's been a mistake. Originally published in the early 1960s, this booklet is only 2 dozen pages with no introduction, explanation, or index. Like ochrocrocus themselves, it doesn't rely on frills, but it's filled with gems like fig cake, a favorite on the island. The original publication has a green cover. There's an edition from the 1980s with a yellow cover. If you can't find either, locals are fond of Cafe Atlantic Cookbook by Ruth Toth, which was reissued in 2015. An original hardcover version in new condition recently appeared on Amazon for $973.90. That's a lot of drum and figs. North Carolina and Old Salem Cookery by Beth Tartan, UNC Press, 1955, revised edition, 1992. Elizabeth Hedgecock Sparks, a.k.a. Beth Tartan, was a food editor of the Winston-Salem Journal for 44 years, part of North Carolina's homemaker triumvirate, along with Helen Moore of the Charlotte Observer and Betty Fizor of WBTV. Before she died in 1992, Tartan traveled all over the state to chase down North Carolina foodways. Her book is remarkably detailed, with an extensive selection on how things were cooked, whether in a fireplace or on a wood-burning stove, for instance, as well as a valuable section on Moravian food and history. The recipes touch on all eras and pretty much every vegetable, fruit, or edible critter that turns up within our borders. Mama Dip's Kitchen by Mildred Council, UNC Press, 1999. Council never claimed her cooking was anything fancy. She called herself a dump cook who threw things together, but folks flocked to her acclaimed Chapel Hill restaurant. Even legendary food writer for the New York Times, Craig Claiborne, who encouraged her to write down recipes. Her first book is a solid collection of country cooking, including chitlins two ways, fried and boiled, and her famous fried chicken. My favorite recipe, though, is the one on the last page for a child's birthday party. Ingredients, balloons, thank you, gift cake, and ice cream. With eight children, she had a lot of patience. The Southern Cookbook by Marion Brown, UNC Press, 1951. Revised and reissued in 1968 and again in 1980. In the pantheon of Southern cookbook authors, Marion Brown isn't a household name. A journalist and radio personality, she lived in Burlington, where she caught her recipe-collecting bug after helping her Episcopal Church Women's Auxiliary put together a small cookbook. She ended up collecting thousands of recipes from all over North Carolina and beyond. Her cookbook is still valued by Southern culinarians as one of the earliest regional cookbooks, capturing a time when Southern food was becoming a bit more cosmopolitan after World War II. The 1968 edition was revised to include simpler recipes, but the 1951 original is a fascinating collection of how North Carolinians cooked, including chicken baked in scuppernong wine and baked beans from the New Ray Inn in Burnsville. Betty Fizor's Carolina Recipes, Volumes 1, 2, and 3 by Betty Fizor, WBTV. Charlotte's Betty Fizor was the queen of the North Carolina TV cooks from the 1950s until her untimely death from cancer in 1978. People have told me that when they were latchkey kids, they'd turn on Betty's show, which aired until 1977 across the Carolinas on WBTV, when they got home from school because it was like having their mothers there. For years, Fizor's spiral-bound books were almost impossible to find. My two copies, Volume 1 and 3, were gifts from readers at the Charlotte Observer, and I treasure them. They're time capsules of 1950s home ways, right down to the salad chapter, where one of the only things green is lime gelatin. These days, they show up on Amazon and eBay. A recent check found an unused copy of Volume 2 for $570.98. Betty would approve if you went for the thriftier used copies, which run $12 to $80, depending on condition. There is a little, I guess you'd call it kind of a sidebar or a follow-up here. It's called Top Shelf. We certainly don't lack for talented chefs and food writers in North Carolina, and their cookbooks have helped spread the secrets of our culinary traditions far and wide. These notable titles deserve a space in every cookbook collection. Bill Neal's Southern Cooking, UNC Press, 1985. I think I'm just going to read the names at this point. Vittles, or Victuals, if you want to spell it out. An Appalachian Journey with Recipes by Ronnie Lundy, Clarkson Potter in 2016. Seasoned in the South, Recipes from Cook's Corner, I've been there. And From Home by Bill Smith, Algonquin Books in 2005. Deep Run Roots, Stories and Recipes from My Corner of the South by Vivian Howard, Little Brown and Company. And The New Southern Garden Cookbook by Sherry Castle, UNC Press, 2011. And finally, Savor the South Cookbook Series from UNC Press. Let's just flip back near the beginning to catch up on a couple of things where we just are almost out of time here. Let's see. We will probably try page 22. I think that would be just about doing it for us. And what's on 22? The Power of a Peanut. This is under the heading Welcome Home Quick Bite Severn. Our royal legume has been with us at baseball games, on hiking trails, and in our homes. For 74 years, Hampton Farms peanuts have helped make memories. As a little boy, Dallas Barnes loved visiting the general store in Northampton County, where he'd pay 15 cents for a glass bottle of Pepsi and a handful of peanuts. Then he'd drop the peanuts into the Pepsi, eating and drinking his snack at the same time. Today, Barnes helps others create similar memories through his company, Hampton Farms, a peanut roaster and distributor that his father, a World War II veteran, and his grandfather co-founded in 1946. Over the years, Hampton Farms has grown into the country's leading roaster of in-shell peanuts. We're not perfect, but we work hard every day, Barnes says. We feel like we're called to do what we're doing. Sure, that calling includes roasting large, crunchy Virginia-style peanuts and using them to create peanut butter, fillings for pretzels, candies, and cookies, and swirls through Turkey Hill ice cream. But the company's real calling is creating experiences. Hampton Farm Peanuts falls into the hands of children at baseball games, families hiking along trails together, and groups of friends on the golf course. They might make you think of the tins you got at Christmas or the sticky candy apples that you got at the fair. Or maybe you can still taste that nutty, sparkling snack and hear the peanuts rolling around the bottom of a glass bottle of Pepsi. So says Catherine Laws. Hampton Peanuts, or Hampton Farms Peanuts, are found at more than 100 retailers nationwide. To find them near you, call 800-313-2748 or visit hamptonfarms.com. There is a picture here of a glass bottle of Pepsi Cola with a little bit of condensation on the outside and a lovely bowl of fresh peanuts. Sweet and salty with a crunch, Hampton Farms Virginia-style peanuts pair perfectly with one of our favorite North Carolina soft drinks. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Sure hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, call the studios, 919-832-5138, and so long until next time.